This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald.
I'm Ramya Amadhin, and this is Kelly and Ramya.
Live from the Accessible Media Studios, this is Kelly and Ramya. Entertainment, lifestyle, and great conversation. It's AMI's on-air community, and everyone's invited.
That time, what time is it? There used to be some show where the guy used to say, the announcer, "Hey kids, what time is it?" Well, it's open. Say it with me, folks. Yeah, swing open the gateway to the weekend. That's that time. Grant Hardy joining me today on the program. So he's given me an extra push to swing it wide open as we welcome you to Kelly and Ramya for the Friday edition of our show. It's funny, when you take things out of context, you almost for a moment lose words. Oh, hold on. What do we say? Swing what? Open? Oh, no. It's swing open. How are you, Grant?
Good, man. Happy Friday. Our Friday show is always super chill and fun to be doing this with you. And then we will swing those gates open as wide as possible for the weekend.
You bet. And it's always so much fun, especially this time of the year. There's a lot going on. People are most, I think, energetic to be outside, to be moving around, because we've been hanging out in Canada in the wintertime, mostly indoors, lack of sunshine, needing the vitamin, and just so happy to embrace. I think we were talking about people just standing around and, oh man, the sun. Oh, feel the warmth. Well, it's still minus one. Oh, you still feel the warmth.
Yeah, it's especially here in BC. We are very sunshine deprived during the winter. I basically forget sometimes what the sun actually feels like. And now we're getting to this point where it's starting to poke through a few nice warm days, which is amazing.
Well, I think for people in hot places, it must be hard for them to believe that our weather's cold enough that sun beaming down, you, as you say, may kind of forget that the sun can be beaming down. And yes, if you can see, you get that concept. If you can't, you may not even really feel anything to know, because it's so cold. And, you know, definitely, unfortunately, we have more days like that during the winter. Anyway, Grant and I would love to tell you what's coming up on our program today. So let's do it. Microsoft Asia unveiled Vasa One, an AI model that can create a synchronized AI, animated AI model of a person talking or singing from a single photo and an existing audio track. We find out more on the app update with John Beeler in a while.
Also, a little confusing situation between New York Yankees manager Aaron Boone and a home plate umpire earlier this year, and that led to much media coverage. Brock Richardson is going to fill us in on the sports update.
Yeah, well, look, you'll hear Brock laughing about that one, that's for sure. And folks, on the program, chatty bookshelf time in the second hour. Ryan Huey is going to be highlighting a nonfiction release by fiction writer James Patterson. Shocking to me, this is titled The Secret Lives of Librarians and Booksellers. Later on, we'll get into that conversation with Ryan. That'll be quite fascinating. Okay, something else interesting and apparently a first, ladies and gentlemen. The fragile lagoon city of Venice has launched a pilot program to charge a fee to hope that the authorities hope will discourage visitors from arriving on peak days and make the city a little more livable for its dwindling residents. This reporter has more from Venice.
Nearly 40,000 people visit Venice every day. That nearly doubles the city's population. Well, now, local authorities are testing out a new system, trying to make sure that this beautiful World Heritage Site doesn't become ruined by too many tourists.
Starting this morning, Venice is now the first and only city in the world to charge day trippers an entrance fee of €5.
Now, okay, a few notes here on this one. Wow, first of all, that's amazing, like doubling the population, 40,000 a day. Anyway, visitors who are not sleeping in Venice will have to show a QR code attesting to that they have paid the tax. Grant, I hear of fees such as entertainment fees, whether you go somewhere like Atlantic City, Vegas. I'm not sure if Vancouver has it, but for going to that place and having fun and enjoying yourself, there's often a fee now that they pay. I think some cities make you pay to get into their downtown area, a little toll, or to bring a vehicle in, maybe not necessarily to walk in, of course, but if you're going to be occupying spaces and causing traffic, they want you to pay for it. But this is a first. Do you think the first of many when it comes to cities, or is Venice just that unique?
Yeah, I was wondering that as I was listening to this. I mean, I guess it is, you know, literally a compliment for them that it's gotten to that point. Yeah, I mean, I guess the population is just exploding so much, more people in more places, that we probably will be seeing a lot more things like this. But it's kind of unfortunate, hey, that that we are separating more and more the kind of haves versus have not people. I mean, €5 might not be that bad, but just all these extra fees, which some people won't be able to afford.
I often wonder if people are funny about Venice. I mean, obviously it's an old city. It isn't meant for the amount of people tramping through there. It's small, it's old. That's, of course, the charm of it. But I also wonder how long people feel, because we start the Venice is sinking. And so many places are lowering, Manhattan, wherever it might be. There's that little bit of movement, that things that are going to happen with all the stuff we put on top. Well, I often wonder, do people flock to Venice because there's that thought, what if tidal wave, unfortunate, some disaster removes such a unique place from our planet? But these places have to start recognizing what they need to do, not only to protect, to control, and also the costs of this kind of volume of people. There must be tremendous costs. So I applaud it. I have to believe, though, there are not going to be that many cities doing this kind of thing unless it's a cash grab. And maybe that's the way they see it. Maybe they feel justified. I mean, after all, if you're getting that many tourists, there's damage, there's costs to the city and towns. Yes, the city and town makes money, but often we have to think about at what cost. Coming up next on the program, ladies and gentlemen, this week we can find the cherry blossom, speaking of attractions out there, blooming at High Park in Toronto. Gardener Susan Kearney tells us more about this popular flower. She also highlights pet grass, something she started growing as a treat for her dogs. That conversation, ladies and gentlemen, as we kick things off right here on Kelly and Ramya.
Don't miss a minute. Kelly and Ramya will be right back.
He's at the home studio in Vancouver. Kelly McDonald here at the home studio, London, Ontario. Check out our show. And if you can't join us live at 2 p.m. Eastern on AMI TV, check us out through AMI Audio. Listen in beginning at 4 p.m. Eastern. You can also listen to one of the repeats of the program at 10 p.m. Eastern on both networks. So anytime you can consume the show, we appreciate it. Thanks for hanging out with us. As Grant's been with me yesterday, he's here today and here on Monday in place of Ramya. So settle on back, because we've got a lot of great content. On Fridays, we usually get that opportunity to talk gardening. And today, what cool topics we have. Let's bring on our gardener, Susan Kearney.
Hello, I'm Susan Kearney. Join me on Kelly and Ramya for the joy of gardening by using touch, taste, scent, and sound.
I think, Suze, I want to get into, as we welcome you back to the show, and always wonderful to have you, I think I want to get into a bit of sense with this, but I'm going to open it up, let you talk about it. And then I kind of have a strange, well, maybe not so strange question for those of us in here on the program and our audience. But let's talk about the blooming this week of the cherry blossoms in High Park in Toronto. Have you been out yet to take a look?
I have not been out for a very long time, but I have actually experienced it. And it's actually lovely. And it doesn't last very long. Of course, it depends on the weather. Sometimes it can last for a week. Sometimes only for a few days, because they're very fragile. So the wind can take them off the trees, and so can heavy rains. And, of course, we had a little bit of frost this week, so I don't know what damage that has done to them. But, they are out in bloom. This is about the time that they come out every year.
So they're definitely like full bloom now.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. The cherry blossoms. Yes, they're in full bloom. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So here's my question, guys. Suze, your experience when you are out and they're in full bloom. I often wonder, especially those of us who can't see, do we get that smell more than effects? If somebody has allergy, they may get some, you know, effects from that. Can you walk us through it? Tell us what you feel when you know blossoms, knowing what you're to expect, what senses it triggers. Can you share that with people on that level? Because like you say, they're not out long. It's that right moment. You've got to be out there to enjoy this outside of seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the cherry blossoms are very fragile. They do have a very sweet scent. In fact, there are perfumes that are made from the perfume of the cherry trees. I don't have the exact number of how many flowers it would take to make, you know, to actually put in to any kind of cherry perfumes, but I would suspect it would be an awful lot. It's a very delicate scent, very beautiful. I actually went when I was quite young. A friend of mine and her mom took us, and some of the cherry blossoms were actually falling from the trees and going onto the grass. She picked them up and put them in our hands so we could feel what they felt like and smell them. It was a very cool experience, and that was the only one time. But every year when I hear that they're out and I hear all the joy from the people who are just walking through that park and to see this, it's quite a spectacular blooming of these beautiful cherry trees.
Hmm. Wow. It's amazing. Tonight I'm supposed to go on a tandem bike ride, so I'm going to try to take an extra ask of my partner who's taken me to see if he sees anything and try to experience that, because it's hit and miss in my mind, depending where you are, where you're going, the time of, and maybe it's not quite the right time here in London yet, but I know my experience on the level you're talking is very limited. There's those times where I'm sure I've said, oh, that's the cherry blossoms. And maybe it's not. Maybe it is.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Grant.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask along similar lines, just thinking about how delicate, as you mentioned, these are. Do we find these are a little bit like hit and miss from year to year? I mean, just thinking about like the weather might have damaged them, you know, some other factors, or do they kind of like tend to make it through and we see a nice fully bloomed cherry blossoms there year after year?
They're very well taken care of, so yes, pretty well. But yes, Mother Nature does have, she has a hand in things, because if there's some full bloom and then we get a very heavy rain, they will be washed off. That is how Mother Nature works. So yes, as soon as they say that they're coming out, that they'll be out in full bloom, then a lot of people flock to the park to see this spectacular show, really, by Mother Nature herself.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. I mean, a lot of it is such a visual thing, because you see the white and everything like that. And then for our senses, for the smell. But if you know when and where, I don't want anyone out there saying, well, you can smell them. Yeah, I know, I get that. But it's, you know, that timing before a rain, a short time, before they fall and everything like that, when they're in bloom. So really, really cool. Let's switch to grasses. You have an interesting member of the grass family, Suze, that you started to grow.
Yes, I actually found this in when I was ordering a bunch of seeds. It's called pet grass, and it actually feels like grass. I planted them. They're in a nice, pretty bowl on my table. It's growing, and I've been giving it to my dogs. You can also give it to guinea pigs and rabbits and cats. At least that's what it says. But my dogs seem to like it, and I will tell you, I've tasted it too. I took a little nibble of a piece when I was cutting it off for my dogs, just so that I figure if it's not going to hurt them, it's not going to hurt me. And it really does taste like grass. It does taste like grass. And it's very interesting. And it doesn't feel like turf grass that, you know, that we know on our lawns. It's much longer and taller. It's right now, some of the strands are about, the leaves are about 6 inches tall. It's very fine. And what I, when I was touching it when it was growing, when we were children and there were, and you would find those long pieces of thick grass that you pull out, and then you would make the, like the, that whistle, that noise.
Yes, or you'd use it as a straw, or you'd use it as a straw, or you'd nibble it. So you're sitting there saying, well, I'm growing the grass. I thought I'd better taste it. And then it flashed me back to, yeah, man, we just tore out it from the lawn and sat there, never even thought of what's been crawling on this at night. What's been nibbling here?
Yeah.
I was always so jealous of people who could make it whistle. I never could do that. It's funny that dogs will eat this, though, actually, isn't it? I mean, well, I know sometimes they eat
grass.
And then they get sick often, don't they? Or am I thinking of cats? Yeah.
No. Dogs do that, and then they get sick. But a lot of our grasses are treated. And whether you treat your grass or not with anything, things blow in. Our water tables, it can wash in if somebody else has put something on your grass. Grass is not a good thing for them to eat. This grass is. It is a member of the oat grass family, so it does have that a little bit of nutrition in it. It doesn't feel like oats, but it does feel like the long pieces of grass. And they, considering they're Labradors, they don't really taste anything. They have been eating it in their dinners, so that's very good. They just swallow their dinners whole, practically. So anyway, I'm hoping that it helps their tummies and maybe stops them from nibbling on grass. I really try not to let my dogs do that.
And when you said turf, Sue, of course, all I thought of is, oh, the grass over at BC Place, the artificial turf. No, nothing. It feels nothing like that. And they're not going to offer that up. What did it taste like to you? Could you taste the oat? Did it kind of have that,
It tasted like green grass. It tasted like eating grass is exactly what it tastes like.
Sue and I know what actual lawns taste like. Leave us alone.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. That's that. How would it, yeah. You know what? I probably nibbled on some grass too when I was a little kid. I don't know.
I probably got sick from that too. My good heavens.
How did you first learn about this?
I found it when I was ordering my seeds from Mackenzie Seeds, and I thought, oh, I'm going to try that and grow that for my two girls. And so there we are. I won't put it out. I'm growing mine indoors. You can grow it outdoors. I won't do that because the bunnies come into the yard and they'll eat it, and the dogs won't get anything.
And like you said, the blowing on it, everything like that, things outside, you want something that for sure is as much as possible, not going to make them sick. It's just fast growing. Give us some kind of concept of this. As you said, it grows, you got it in the bowl, so obviously you're rationing out how much you give.
Well, yes. I just cut it down a little bit, and then it just keeps on growing back up. And I just give them a little tiny wee bit. But I planted it one day, and within 3 days that it had germinated. By 5 days, I was actually feeding it to them.
Crazy. Oh,
that's really cool.
How are they liking it, the dogs?
I'm not sure because they I don't think they taste their dinners.
Oh, okay, right. You said that. True. I mean, we already asked you what you think of the taste. Yeah, but that's true. They tend to inhale dinners anyway. So if you're taking some of those trimmings and putting them in there, do you mix it in with what they're eating, or actually give it to them on its own?
I put it like a garnish.
Yeah, like a salad garnish.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
you're looking after those dogs well. Should we talk a little bit about, let's talk about this. So on April 17th, we celebrated, this is really cool, International Appreciation of Bats Day. I know a lot of people find bats maybe a little creepy or something. I've always found bats to be very cool. Why should we appreciate bats?
They are extremely, extremely important for our ecosystems. They do an awful lot. And I'm going to ask, if you know what the most poisonous creature on Earth is.
Oh, poisonous. Most they used poisonous? To go on about that one lizard, the Komodo dragon, and say things about it because of the bacteria. But I think, is it the black adder, the snake?
No. No, it is actually the mosquito.
Wow. Okay.
And that makes sense.
Yes, it kills more people around the world in 1 year than any other poisonous creature. And that's one of the reasons why bats are very important, because they can eat many times their weight in mosquitoes. They actually eat them and you know, get rid of them. And they also are wonderful pollinators, and they are pollinators at night. They are nighttime pollinators, so any plants that are open at night, not all are, many are not, but many fruit trees, some are, and they are very good pollinators of those particular types of plants that are open at night, so they can spread the pollen. They also eat seeds. And when they eat the seeds, they actually put the seeds out and replant those plants. This is very important. And the different kinds of seeds that they eat, it's very important to our ecology, what plants they actually eat, and drop those seeds for those plants to come back again. Very important creature.
Wow. Yeah. Talk about reciprocal. Talk about what the importance that we sit here and, oh, I don't want that in my house, but we also know, hey, they can't help. Don't dispose them. Don't kill them, because they're as valuable. And I think you just gave us so many cases. Imagine if we didn't have them to eat the amount of mosquitoes they do, like several times the weight. That's unbelievable to even think there's enough there for them to do so. Awesome stuff, Sue. Thank you.
Bye.
Had no idea they were pollinators, folks. Folks, we visit with our gardener once a week on Fridays to kick off our show. So please join us as we get into talks and, like today, learn a lot. Now, we're going to take a break. I'm going to go graze on some grass. Coming up next, our app update. John Beeler joins us also from Vancouver in 2 minutes.
Stick around and learn something new. Kelly and Rumya return with more in a moment.
Rolling through your Friday. Swinging open the gateway to the weekend, getting you set up, as we always love the content on our show, because it gives you so many ideas of things you may want to catch up on, maybe something you want to do, maybe, hey, man, it's a rainy weekend, but we have got all sorts of stuff to keep you covered. If it's a nice one, well, we kick things off with gardening and get right into all sorts of things. Grant Hardy joining me today. I'm Kelly McDonald.
Always lots of things happening in tech as the weeks go on, and so it's time to check in with John Beeler for our weekly app update.
Hi, I'm John Beeler, technology expert from Vancouver. Join me on Kelly and Ramya, where I share the latest app, mobile, and tech news. Everything from accessibility and product launches to privacy and security. We'll cover the gamut.
It's always amazing how much things change just from last week to this week. So many new apps and developments and changes. So, John, it's always great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with Twitter alternative Post News. Apparently, they are closing down.
Yeah, to surprise of no one. most people probably don't even remember what Post News is. And this was one of the platforms that popped up soon after Elon Musk purchased Twitter. And everyone was just flocking to every new service to try to find the next Twitter. And this one had kind of an interesting promise or premise, I guess. It was created by the founder and former CEO of Waze, the navigation system that was owned by, that's now owned by Google, and they've integrated it into Google Maps. And so he created this platform as meant to sort of be the toxic free space for people that are really interested in sort of news and conversation and those types of things. And one of the interesting things that they offered that I don't think anyone else really has done is they give you ad-free access to paywalled content from some pretty big publishers like Fortune, Business Insider, Wired, Boston Globe, et cetera. And you didn't have to pay for separate subscriptions for those things. You would just pay a couple pennies for that specific article. And so it really gives you a lot more access to content than you would have without breaking the bank as far as having to have a lot of subscription services for paywalled content. They had a wait list, and once they removed the wait list, I think in November of 2022, they basically said that they only had about just under 500,000 subscribers people on the platform, which is very small change compared to a lot of the other competition out there. So essentially, the CEO of Post said, we were just not growing fast enough to become a real business or a significant platform, as he said. So they're shutting down in a few weeks, and another one bites the dust, thanks to Elon.
It's so tough, isn't it, right? Because just thinking about, if I needed, whatever, customer service or to put a fundraising message out there, whatever it is, realistically, this is more news focused, but yeah, like realistically, you'd go to the big guys, right? Reddit, Twitter, Facebook, whatever other competitors are like trying so hard. And I'd love to see something else get mass adoption, but it's just hard when everything is so established already.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I think the other interesting thing is that the ones that popped up at around the same time as Post that are still around and, actually quite thriving are the ones that have the connection to the Fediverse. So Mastodon, Threads, these systems that, the promise hasn't quite delivered yet in the sense that it doesn't matter what platform you're on, you can still connect and get your message out to all the other platforms, but we're getting closer to that every day.
I wonder too, for a lot of people who play on Twitter, they like their quick headlines. They like being in the association with a lot of media and availability, but that's not a reason for a lot of other people. They want to more communicate with the people that they're fans of or potentially, as opposed to a heavy resource of, hey, I like my headlines, I like my news, but I'm getting it also that little bit that's good enough for me with the other resources, John. I know for me, I kind of like the way that I can see something tweeted out by a reporter and stuff like that. That's something for me where a lot of other people, just send something from the news agency.
It just proves it's really hard to make something that works for everybody, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think when something doesn't work, we know, but that's because the Kellys out there looking for news, there's not as many as those out there who want to follow, some artist, some sports figure or whatever. Your second item, sir, Microsoft. Mm-hmm. Vasa One, it can deep fake, and I'm probably not saying it right, I know, fake a person with one audio track, and that includes the photo.
Yeah, this is a fairly significant development in deep fake technology. Previously, you would need lots of different sort of reference photos or videos or a video that they would just digitally alter to change the way the voice comes through and the lips are in sync, those types of things. Mm-hmm. But this particular model that Microsoft's research department has come up with was actually trained on about 6,000 celebrities on YouTube with over there was just a really large amount of sort of contextual video with these 6,000 celebrities. So every possible facial movement and things like that, we're training this AI model. So now literally just with a still photo that you would grab off of Facebook or something else, you can actually create a fully animated video of me or you talking. You provide an audio track, and they're very careful to say that this isn't a one-stop deep fake tool, because it'd be really disastrous if I could just take a political figure a photo of a political figure and then some text and have the AI, you know, have that person say everything all in one place and have it look as photorealistic as this particular model is promising. Although, ironically, Microsoft has other tools that do that aspect of it. So you still need to create the audio file or have an audio file, but you can essentially have one photo and you can have that person animated singing a song or speaking, you know, a speech or whatever you want, in an incredibly photorealistic way. And they're basically saying it's, you know, it's a very high definition. There is still some identifiers in the, I guess, the video encoding of this particular output that is very easy to determine that is AI generated, which is on purpose so that it can be detected very easily.
Yeah. And this one's just so interesting because it's basically like when we train a software to hear our voice and how you speak. So you train this to see or to hear, to be able to mimic. But not only that, it flashes it back to, as Kelly would say this, his face would make this expression due to the design of his face and everything, based on everything it's learned through those other 6,000 images of people and things like that out there to compile. This is what a face should do when you do this or saying that. That to me is just amazing for the length of time that said. And like you say, you could sit there, pull enough audio because there's so many things out there, speeches from our celebrities or whomever, and utilize this. And we're always recording stuff. There's always YouTube or videos of just anybody out there off of Facebook or whatever, you grab that and could do it. So, I mean, I guess it's a blessing that we're making sure these things make sure that that's embedded. But, you know, John, the average person's going to get nailed believing it's them.
Oh, absolutely. And this is the problem, is that the average person is not going to look at the code or look at the encoding of this video to determine or not. It's only when it gets shared a lot and goes viral that people will start poking the bear and trying to figure out, well, where did this come from? This person never would say that way or whatever. But just the sheer amount of progress that we've seen in these deepfake systems is just astonishing in the short amount of time that they've been around.
Especially if you think, unless you're a celebrity, somebody known where it's going to be shared, and that some of this stuff could really affect small groups of people, someone who's at a school, a high school, and that, and somebody gets loose and putting it out there. I think that's so dangerous because a lot of people aren't going to ever stop promoting. Who would bother to copy Kelly? Who would create an? Who would do that? Why?
Well, there was just an example of someone. Oh, sorry, Grant.
No,
there's just
ahead,
an example of someone that used this kind of technology to try to get someone fired at a school. And they basically made it sound like the principal said something that they didn't actually say.
No. And that's exactly what I was thinking is, you know, someone like, I don't know, Taylor Swift, you know, like people are going to expect fake, you know, videos of celebrities coming out, but you know, someone like me or, you know, some random person, you know, creating a video that has some sort of racist or, you know, horrible comment, whatever, even just the notoriety of it, like that could do terrible damage. And I find it so interesting that, you know, currently the AI companies are saying like, okay, we're not going to generate, you know, abusive content. We're going to put some watermarks in here, whatever it is, but that's just all a policy thing. Like you totally could create an AI that would do whatever you wanted and not add watermarks. So yeah, I don't know how I feel about this. I'm wondering if we're coming up to a kind of 1984 style where you'll just have no idea how to tell if something is real and what is fake. So hopefully not.
I think everyone will just start to distrust everything. I mean, we saw that with Photoshop.
Sure.
You know, you couldn't trust a magazine photo and now you can't trust a video.
Well, we'll let that mull over on that a little bit and see what happens. Speaking of AI, Meta AI launches in Canada on WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook, and more. I think I've seen a new little tab there in my Facebook app. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, this is somewhat controversial in the sense that basically Meta has sort of plugged in their AI tools into just about every aspect of their software. And it's quite confusing for the average person because it replaces things like on Instagram, the search button. It's now replaced with the Meta AI, and it says, ask Meta anything. And I'm trying to find an Instagram account, and it's unclear whether that's going to like be a ChatGPT prompt or if that's going to be a search result within Instagram. And I've seen a few friends on Facebook sort of confused over this and sort of like, how do you turn this off? And there's no way to turn it off. It's sort of there. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that Meta and other companies are trying to sort of force feed us all these AI bots to give us the ability to have it write an email for you or write a blog post or an Instagram post with all the right tags that you need to do so that your post will go viral, those types of things. But also it's just kind of like, why can't I turn it off?
Yeah, it was just confusing to me. I tried this out and like, oh, I'm looking for, you know, a specific person I'd like to friend. And like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't look through Facebook accounts, but I can help you come up with some ideas of things to do on the weekend or whatever. And like, I don't know what the point of this is really.
No, exactly. And I'm trying to figure out what is the goal from Meta other than showing off their language models. But nobody I know has had a successful result with anything they've asked it for. Even when they're specifically asking for things that it's supposed to help you with, it's still right. Not working properly.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Any thoughts on this real quick, Kelly?
No, it's amazing to me just the way it goes and the timing. I mean, obviously, these things take time to get them where we need them. And I guess, John, that's what we just have to stop and kind of grin and bear it. But I always think it's the vastness, too, of whether you just have some people things rolled out to or the whole shebang. It's a lot of people playing around.
Yeah, I think
I will say I did find one way to sort of, I guess, minimize its usefulness is at least on Instagram. If you tap on the icon for the Meta AI, you actually get its profile and you can actually block it. So
then it'll
stop working that way and sort of work like a regular search bar. So
I'll keep looking for ways to do that. Sounds like a good first step. We are out of time, man, but thanks for the great info.
No problem.
That's John Beeler, who will be back next Friday and every Friday for that weekly app update.
Ahead, folks, Disney has launched changes to its longstanding disability access service. And of course, folks, we know these things happen, but we got to speak up about them, right? And they're facing lots of backlash from disability communities. We're going to get the scoop on the buzz with Nisreen Abdul-Majeed after this.
Keep it here for more of Kelly and Ramya on AMI TV.
Always love having you on board. Ladies and gentlemen, we're here weekdays, so 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI TV. Always wonderful to have you settled in with us, listening in on AMI Audio around the world. We kick off our show at 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio. Maybe you check us out through TuneIn Radio or OOTunes. Grant Hardy settled in with me today, and we're interested in all the subjects we've got on the docket today because they keep us busy, keep us talking, keep us thinking, and also just so fascinating. So we have this segment Wednesday through Fridays. We call it The Buzz. And this is one of those ones where we talk about a variety of different things. So many things are assembled. We listen, chat, give some feeling and thought. And hosting it today for us, who's been with us all week, is Nisreen Abdul-Majeed. Niz, how are you today? What's happening?
Pretty good. Happy Friday. We have some interesting articles today.
Oh, man, you betcha.
That's so we're going to start with the question of the day, I guess. Are plant-based meat substitutes really better for the heart than meat options? A new research was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that compared diets containing real meat to those using plant-based meat alternatives. The study mainly looked at cardiovascular health and diabetes risks. So they found that there was no clear advantage of one diet over the other in improving heart health. Those eating animal meat managed their blood sugar levels better, as well as experiencing blood pressure improvements. And this suggests that the benefits often associated with plant-based diets might not directly apply to plant-based meat alternatives, as they differ nutritionally from whole plant foods and their impact on heart health. This was surprising when I saw this study. This was really surprising. I did not think that wouldn't improve over the other.
Yeah, this is going to be very controversial, I think, and heat up the debate about plant-based versus, you know, meat versus animal rights versus health. There's all this kind of thing. This is, I don't know about you, Kelly. I don't think this is what I would have expected either, to be honest.
With plant-based, I'm not sure. Okay, I don't know enough to be honest with you, but I know that when we talk whole vegetable salads and things like that, we know that it's not the veggies, it's what we put on it. And all the things we're talking about, we'll throw stuff on our meat, maybe. We'll throw stuff on that salad. We have to butter or you know, oil to death the vegetables we may be cooking, or dipping them the veggies in something. So I'm not sure what people kind of add to the plant-based. I don't know if that part of the study was, no, eat the stuff without putting your barbecue sauce all over the meat, without doing, I don't know, but I have to wonder, because that's what I've always heard. Oh, it's not the salad. It's all the stuff you put on the salad, or the kind of salad, or all those raisins that you throw in it, and pecans. It's the damage we do that way. And I have to wonder if they negated that in the study, if they just said, okay, we need the stuff to be straightforward, and I don't eat enough plant-based food, to really know what people throw on it. And is it much the same things that you would put on your meat or your other things that would make you say, hey, there's tons of sour cream here, if you're comfortable with eating the sour cream?
I agree. And I also wonder whether plant-based meat products come into play, which are highly processed foods versus, like, you know, just a natural, you know, whatever, lentils, beans,
right,
nuts, veggies versus that, like, plant-based burger, whatever,
processed versus the processed meat burger, and we would never match up with whole, because obviously no, there's no, you sit there and have a portobello mushroom burger, the benefits are great, but not if you're dumping a whole bunch of mustard and relish and cheese and everything else on it. Okay, really cool.
Exactly.
I agree with both of you. I feel like I like my meat, but I see what you guys are saying. It's what you put on it, and the damage is done. I damage my food then, pretty much.
Oh, no. Well, we talked about salt, man. Look at the salt, right? Yeah. And like I was talking the other day about, oh, yeah, Mom really loved that. Look at those white caps of your fries. Get out. What are you doing to yourself? And that thank God that was years ago, and I can laugh about it now. But I stop and think, what if I kept that up? Like, I mean, good grief. You know, I already have, you know, health things that I have to keep in mind all the time, let alone, you know, doing something like that to myself and saying, oh my God, so I can at least sit here.
Yeah, man, I quit that nonsense. Yep. Now I just only laden down the salts on the potato chips.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to have to work on that too. Yeah, let's move on to the next one. This should be a good discussion.
Yeah, this is a really good discussion. So Disney faces backlash over the theme park disability access change. Disney has announced changes to its longstanding disability access service, DAS. Previously, guests with disabilities who may have struggled to stand in line for extended periods of time were able to schedule rides in advance and then wait in a different place until their turn. Starting May 20, at Disney World and June 18 at Disneyland, this service will only be offered to visitors with developmental conditions such as autism spectrum disorder. And the move is in response to a perceived rising number of non-disabled guests pretending that they have a medical condition to take advantage of the service and skip the queues. Data shows that the use of the DAS program has skyrocketed since 2019, making it the most widely requested service across the Disney parks. and a coalition of 140 people have signed a letter to Disney's upper management and CEO, in which they accuse the corporation of discriminating against people living with disabilities, and such as conditions like cancer, narcolepsy, Parkinson's, PTSD, multiple sclerosis, the list goes on. This is an example of people ruining it for everyone else, for people that really need this service. So that's unfair, I have to say.
Yep. Shame on the people who are doing that kind of garbage. And we've heard about this everywhere, whether it's in airports. I want to jump the line, so I'll pretend to have this and that. But a further shame, folks, to those who the answer to solve this is penalize everyone. Not the people who need the service, who aren't faking. Let's penalize them more than the person says, oh, I guess I can't get away with that now. No, ho-hum. And moves along to actually waiting in line or finding a way to make another scam. They're not supposed to be doing it. You know that. But you're not going to take the chance of accusing the wrong person of faking and have them come running with the lawyer and the judge, which is what the biggest concern is. Or just admit, are you that cheap, Disney? Does it mean, like, how does this affect? And again, I guess that is more the concern of a lawsuit picking on the wrong person because everybody's paid for their tickets, are going in there. It's this attitude of our society. It's like the kid when you were, you know, I remember being a kid and, okay, guys, in the classroom, who took the this and that? Guys, somebody took it. All right, all of you missed recess.
Yeah.
Because we're trying to tell whoever doesn't want to miss recess, come up here and think on the person that, you know, took it, or the person who's going to say, oh, no, no, I don't want anyone to miss recess. These people aren't going to stop what they're doing. They're going to change their tactic, and they're going to try to appear in with a disability that qualifies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Grant, what do you think?
I think this is really just yucky on so many levels. Mm-hmm. I mean, just, you know, even just thinking for myself, I've never thought that I particularly needed to skip the line. Although one thing someone pointed out to me, you know, is a little kid who can't see, you know, you might be at a bit of a disadvantage because you can't see what's happening around you in the lineup and have other things to kind of distract you with necessarily. But I, like I said, I've never felt a huge desire to skip the lines. But the people this is really going to hurt are, for example, people with, you know, chronic pain who find it hard to stand for extended periods of time. And just people with other complex medical needs that for whatever reason find waiting in a line stressful or gives them anxiety or whatever. And well, not whatever, but you know what I mean? A long list of things. And yeah, it's unfortunate because I don't know what to do about fakers. And we see this in so many things, even people pretending to be, you know, I think people have faked being indigenous or faked, you know, needing to have a guide dog, whatever it is. But I don't think the solution is to ruin it for everyone. I think
it away from everyone. But I also get, and I'll be fair, as much as I get, I'm so furious with Disney and other places that take this tactic. I'm like you, Grant. I don't have an answer as to how could they walk up and say, hey, you, Hardy, you come in here pretending you're blind. You're not blind. I am blind. No, you're not. And the lawsuit that follows.
Yeah. And I think I've actually heard before, and I know this is really frustrating and not ideal, but I've heard before, you know, maybe you just have to count on a certain amount of people who are faking it and
that's right.
Not accept it, but like at least just don't let them ruin your day and don't let them
the ruin cost of business, just like those who fake injuries at these parks and get away with the stuff they get away with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's as you said, Grant, like it's a yucky situation. It's not fair. We don't have a solution, but this is not the solution. Yeah. I'm going to go to article number 3 before we end the segment because this is funny. So a potty themed party celebrating San Francisco's celebrity bathroom concludes $1.7 million toilet saga. So Noe Valley Town Square in San Francisco held a party called the Toilet Bowl to celebrate the opening of a new public toilet that almost cost $1.7 million. This throne ended up costing the city far less, but still worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Acrobats juggled plungers. Children circled a maypole clutching long strands of toilet paper. And they even served lemonade and chocolate cupcakes decorated with poop emojis. The party marked the end of more than a year of political fighting over the project. There was controversy, and the toilet burst made headlines when the original proposal was mocked for having a price tag of $1.7 million. In the end, the project was still... it still costs $200,000. I mean, it's far less than 1.7, but that's hundreds of thousands of dollars for the public toilet. It's ridiculous.
That's a lot.
They're expensive. And they allegedly are these self-cleaning. They do things, apparently, some of these ones. I'm not sure if that's it. That might be the higher price range. So I don't know. But, oh, my goodness, what do you think of this party? Like, okay. But you want people to know it's there, and you want them to get the theme of it, you know, in meaning kind of harmless. I'm also giggling over the fact that when you started filling in last week here, your first story was about the fuel, the poop fuel, the sewage fuel. I was going to say, what a way to finish off your time.
Look
right
at this
here.
Theme. Yeah.
Holy goodness, Reen. That's top. Talk about top and bottoming it, or top and tailing. Anyway. Awesome. Awesome. Thanks, thank you, Niz. Really appreciate you doing this for us too on the show. Join us next Wednesday for the next Buzz. Laura Bain, our new member of the team, will be taking us through things and picking up the ball. And that will start next Wednesday as we do the Buzz Wednesday through Fridays right here on Kelly and Rumya. In the next hour of said program, let's get the conversation recaps and comment on segments from the past week. We call the segment Cut for Time. And on the Chatty Bookshelf, Ryan Hui is going to highlight a nonfiction release by fiction writer James Patterson titled The Secret Lives of Librarians and Booksellers. But up next, a confusion situation between New York Yankees manager Aaron Boone and a home plate umpire garnered lots of media attention this week. Brock Richardson fills us in on our sports update after this.
Keep it here for more of Kelly and Rumya on AMI TV.
We're launching into hour two. It's Kelly and Rumya. Ladies and gentlemen, swinging open the gateway to your weekend with lots of content ahead, including book talk. We'll get into our Cut for Time and give you some suggestions for things you may want to go back and check out via the podcast. But right now, it's time to get into, as we do on Fridays to kick off the second hour of the show, our sports update with Brock Richardson.
I'm Brock Richardson, and I love sports. As a former pro athlete, I bring you the sports angle beyond the headlines, plus parasport news and analysis.
Welcome back, sir. Glad to have you on a Friday and getting us set up for the weekend at the busiest sports month of the year. Sports month of the year. What's your leadoff item for today, my friend?
Yes, lots of good stuff I have for you today, so let's dive right into it. Basketball Canada confirmed this week that they are sticking with their coach, Jordy Fernandez, to go through the 2024 Olympic Games. I don't think this is a surprise. He was around when they qualified. He took over for Nick Nurse. He has also been hired by the Brooklyn Nets to begin their season next year. So lots of good stuff going on for Jordy Fernandez. And I don't think this comes as a surprise, as he carried them through to the Olympic berth. So, yeah.
Are you glad on this one?
Yeah, I think so. I think in the end you needed stability. I mean, Nick Nurse obviously moved on to the Philadelphia 76ers, and I think that was part of it there. I think he said, you know, it's a lot of time commitment when you're coaching in two different cities and et cetera. So, yeah, I like this just for consistency factor, and he deserves it given that he was the man who was the coach who brought them into the Olympics. So congratulations to him.
You wish good things. You hope that, I mean, this team in Canada, ladies and gentlemen, our basketball team for probably the first time, if we were able to bring everybody onto it as possible that we could have on it, since there's so much talent out there, you got so much, it's a plethora of talent. And let's just keep our fingers crossed of who can play. A lot of people putting a lot of time in, a lot of Canadians making it in the playoffs that would be on the team. So they're going to come in tired, but I think they'll do us proud no matter who makes that team, Brock. So fantastic. Thank you.
All right, fantastic. Let's talk about women's basketball. And women's basketball superstar Caitlin Clark was drafted by the Indiana Fever. Am I saying that correctly? Unfortunately, I guess something else kind of took the limelight there during her introductory press conference. What's going on with all this, Brock?
Yes. So essentially what happened was, when she was introduced by the Fever, there was a reporter, and we'll refer to him as Mr. Doyle for this conversation. And the reporter, before asking a question, made the hand motion of a heart, so putting his two hands together and then motioning to her. Caitlin responded back and said, "You like that? I do that with my family before every game." The reporter responded, "If you continue to do this with me, we'll get along just fine." This caused a lot of very interesting conversation. It made a lot of people cringe a little bit because it was something that they kind of thought, would you do that if it was a male? I don't think so.
Totally not,
Mr. Doyle. Mr. Doyle sent out an apology in which you had to click on the article to open the apology. In the apology, he was saying that both literally and figuratively, this motion was meant from my heart. It might have been a poor choice on my part. Both of your reactions to this is what?
I mean, this is kind of yucky. Like, it's... Yeah, it's like some people just can't help themselves. They have to make some kind of, you know, stupid, like bordering on sort of, I don't know if it's rises to the level of harassing, but kind of borderline, you know, I don't know, flirtatious comment when like it's not necessary at all. You're there to talk about her sport and her achievement. I think this was a very poor choice.
Brock, again, being low vision enough that I don't really relate to a lot of these gestures, emojis, and things like that unless it's described to me. I think the big point there that you guys have mentioned so far, too, is that would you have done that to a man? But we also know right now female sports are really taking hold and people are impressed. We always say, what is the reason you're impressed? What is the reason you're backing it? This is legitimate sport. These are legitimate high caliber athletes doing what they're doing. And it's been a fault in our world to not recognize this. But I do feel sometimes, and I think being a disabled person, it's like, Brock, oh, good for you. You put two words together. You know, that kind of moment where we feel sometimes like, look, all I did is poured my milk into my coffee. Okay, yeah. But sometimes people are blown away by it. And sometimes it's ignorance. Sometimes they'll be the first person to say, I'm sorry, maybe I'm making a mountain out of a mole. I'm embarrassed or whatever. I have no idea enough to know what that means if he's, you know, being perverted or whatever. I understand. No, he probably wouldn't do that if it was a gentleman. But I also have been hearing so much about the way people are raving over the ladies' sports, and all these athletes want to do is play their sport. They want you to come out and enjoy them. They want to be paid fairly for the professional sports that are out there. They want to make their WNBA team the same way guys want to make their NBA team. That's all they want, is to go out and live the dream and enjoy it the same way you or I would, Brock. And you know, as being, you know, a former athlete, a Paralympian, you know what it meant. I know what it meant, just playing sport and being able to get out and do some of the things and have a sport that I could call my own. Never mind, well, what adjustments is it made to make it accessible? I don't care. Mm-hmm. I want to play a sport. Yeah. I want to be a part of a team. So I don't know, Brock, your feelings.
I think for me, where if he had just made the hand gesture and just carried on, I think I would have said, okay, reading his apology, you know, and saying, I really meant it in a good way. I was trying to connect with her. I think where I kind of go, yeah, but then you took it over the line where you said, if you continue to do that to me, we'll get along just fine.
Yeah, that's not great.
That you can't defend. and say, no. "Oh, it was really well meant. It was well intended." You could have said that if you just left it at the heart emoji and moved on. Now that you've taken it a step further, that's where it's like, now you're creepy because you're also.
Well, and she did try to say, so, "This is something I do with my family, buddy."
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, we look at it that way. I take it a bit further in the other meanings in that, because here we know this fella, you can't do that stuff. You can't. No. Why should you want to make anyone feel awkward? Okay. Has there been any consequence?
Just an apology. Thus far, he's still working. As far as I know, I did some research just before came on this segment, and as far as I can tell, he's still working. If I was Caitlin, I would be saying he's not welcome in my press room when I'm doing pressers, but that's not been quoted. That's just Brock Richardson speaking as a, if it were me, this is what I would do. I'm not trying to speak for Caitlin in this case. So far, it's just an apology.
Okay.
Interesting situation with New York Yankees manager Aaron Boone. Apparently, he's quite a character as well, with the home plate umpire this year. What in the heck is going on with this?
Yes, so they had an afternoon game this week between the Oakland Athletics and the New York Yankees. And during this game, he was barking a little bit with home plate umpire Hunter Wendelstadt, complaining about balls and strikes. At the beginning of all this, guys, Hunter Wendelstadt said, say no more, I'm the umpire, and Aaron Boone made a hand gesture, which basically signified, okay, I've heard you. A person behind the dugout, a fan in a blue shirt, made a remark, and Hunter Wendelstadt subsequently threw Aaron Boone out. Aaron Boone came running out and said, I didn't say anything. It was the fan. I didn't say anything. He protested. This was in the first inning of this game on a Monday. And Hunter Wendelstadt said, I don't care who said it, you're gone. Then Hunter Wendelstadt was asked by the Athletic, what's going on here? And Hunter Wendelstadt was quoted in saying, Aaron Boone is the manager of the New York Yankees and needs to manage what goes on in the dugout. We need to keep players on the field because that is what fans pay for. I can understand that if Aaron Boone was the one or somebody in the dugout said it. It's very obvious in a short video that I've seen that the fan says it. Now, do you have to go to replay? Sure. But I think Mr. Wendelstadt wanted to make a point, and I think this was a bit also clunky. And then to double down and basically say, I don't care, you're gone in the first inning, a bit too much.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to see all these things reviewed. I certainly think this is something that the league head office should look at and remind Wendell, hey, come on, all right, that went a little far. There's been a couple of these get out moments lately that have been hot-headed umpires. I'm not sure if they feel they're losing some control over stuff, or maybe there's been some meetings of late. We know in the NBA, there was a very different feel after a meeting earlier in the season that changed the way that refs were calling the game. So, Brock, that's kind of where I'm at with it. I don't want to see reviewed, but this is such a unique one. Things like that can happen, certainly a mistake like that. But I think an umpire's got to be empowered enough to say, oh, okay, so maybe I heard wrong. Okay. Instead, but unfortunately, your reputation carries you, and it's certainly Boone is very capable of coming out there and getting himself into that trouble.
Umpires have not been doing so well this year with balls and strikes, so I can see why everything's going on. Everyone's a little uptight. Proceed, Kelly.
Yeah, I think so. You have a special guest coming up on the Neutral Zone that you wanted to comment on.
We do. This episode will drop this Tuesday, April 30th. We're going to be joined by Devin Haru. Devin Haru is a jack of all trades, and I wrote in the intro of this, master of all of them, because he's really good at what he does. We're going to run the gamut with him. We're going to talk curling. We're going to talk Olympics. We're going to talk Paralympics, all kinds of stuff. So stay tuned for that this week. It'll drop in the morning on Tuesday. So please tune in. We would appreciate it.
And, of course, we all recognize Brock and have to say the loss of Bob Cole, a broadcaster of such talents and gifts, started in 1973, died at the age of 90. And you, Brock, as a curling fan, recognize he was a curler and also in political office. So really lost not only a fantastic announcer that some will even credit their career to in hockey, and a wonderful voice and somebody who had so many opportunities to help so many others in his field, but help so many others around and in sports. So very sad for that loss. Definitely going to miss him. Thanks, Brock.
True icon and true legend. That's all I'll say.
Brock Richardson visits with us at the top of our second hour on Fridays to talk sports right here on Kelly and Rumya. Coming up next, the Chatty Bookshelf. Let's get into an incredible conversation today with Ryan Hui. He's going to be highlighting a nonfiction release by fiction writer James Patterson titled The Secret Lives of Librarians and Booksellers. We'll get into that with him after this. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a call out for you. It's that time again. AMI and Halifax Comedy Fest are filming a second all access comedy special. This is going to be on May 12th. Access Comedy is a stand-up comedy special unlike any other out there, with comedians from the disability community coming together to celebrate their unique outlook on life for a full packed house of audience members. The next all-access comedy will be filmed on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. Eastern at the Spats Theater. That's in Halifax, Nova Scotia, of course. And if you want to get your tickets, and folks, I'm going to throw a nice word in here, one we love to hear, free tickets for this, for all-access comedy, and you can reserve those at halifaxcomedyfest.ca. Enjoy it if you get a chance to go as they get that taping together for all of us to enjoy it around the country here on AMI TV. Kelly McDonald, settle in here with Grant Hardy.
It's time now for the Chatty Bookshelf, where we talk all things audiobooks with Ryan Hui.
Who knew an entire library could fit inside your pocket? I'm Ryan Hui. This is the Chatty Bookshelf, where we talk audiobook trends, news, and author interviews.
All right, this is going to be a fun conversation, I think, today. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Yeah, I think they're all fun, aren't they? Or is it just the
They are fun, but this...
Okay, I was just checking, just confirming.
All right, let's talk about this really cool book-related initiative going on in Turkey.
This one was probably one of the coolest stories I found all year long. It's been blowing up social media, and it all started by just a few people, public works department workers in Turkey, that noticed a huge spike in the number of children's books they were seeing in the trash. They were picking up trash throughout neighborhoods, throwing it in the garbage truck, and they said there was just a ton of books. So what they did was they started collecting them. Instead of having these go to the landfill, they started collecting them, but they didn't know what to do with it. And as the story goes, one of the people filled up his garage and was like, we need to do something with this. So what they did, they rented a sort of warehouse kind of thing. They're calling it a warehouse, but it's more like a shipping container right now. A little bit bigger than that, as opposed to what people have described the picture as. And they put over 2,000 children's books and some adult books in there for people to come by, and they've opened up a library. It's take what you want and just bring them back when you're done, or donate them somewhere else, kind of the mantra of it all. And it's turned into this really good community hub for literacy and for community, just having some fun and going out and doing your thing and meeting some people, meeting some friends and family that also read.
Yeah. This to me reminds me on our level of what you brought to us about the libraries in the airports, in the sense of stuff that people, hey, trade the book off, leave your book. You know, we're talking gently used or used stuff. Now, I'm going to say gently. Obviously, if people are throwing these books out, they either feel the kids have read them, they don't need them, or that's the way people are. And we here forget, because we're sitting there saying, oh, God, they're pulling them out of the garbage. Yikes. Well, to a lot of people in the world, most of the world, our secondhand clothes are fantastic. If they can be worked on, they'll go and they'd rather buy them, you know, that way. They don't have all these stores and buying these things the way we are, the mall to go to. And let's spend an afternoon there getting all sorts of brand new stuff. The brand new to them is the stuff that we get from, you know, the Goodwill bin dropping off and things like that, that we say, well, I'll just get something from there. And for many of us, we know that's perfectly good. Books sitting around for years.
And you know what the best thing about this story is? That they didn't have to do anything. They didn't have to start. They could have just went through and been lackadaisical. Cool, a lot of books. Let's throw them in the back of the truck and keep going. Yeah. And they go through their daily lives. Everybody has, you know, issues. Everybody has, you know, concerns and things going on in their lives and priorities. And these guys took it upon themselves to say, no, this is a problem. What can we do to help? What can we set up? And how can we help our community? And
that's our people will appreciate it.
Yeah, that saying, one person's trash, another person's treasure. It's baffling, like how many, you know, everything from like furniture to books to, you know, some things have to go, but the amount of stuff that's literally like perfectly good that another kid would not only tolerate but like actually love that just get tossed into the garbage is insane. Exactly. I'd love to see that automated some way to kind of sort through it, but at least we've got these grassroots initiatives that are really making a difference here.
Cleaning the books and away we go with them. Ryan, anything online? You said it's been blowing up some of the great comments, especially from people in Turkey or people in other countries that just see this as, wow, I wish someone was doing that here.
The internet is strange, and it giveth and it taketh away, right? So some of the comments, extremely positive, other ones, extremely negative, and there's not really in the middle. So it's either you love it or you hate it for whatever your reason is, but more, it's getting more love than it is hate. But it's really funny to me, you know, the things that people are bringing up that they hate about it. Like you said, oh, they're garbage books. And it's like, that's what you're concerned about. It's unbelievable. But the fact that these people are getting some support and, you know what, people are like, hey, we got boxes of books and we want to donate too. So they've been branching off and they're not just all garbage books, but this is how it kind of started off, right? And it was just finding them and let's reuse them. Let's reduce the waste and let's recycle them. Let's get them into someone else's life. Cause you know, whatever book it is and, you know, Kelly's read it, but maybe Ryan hasn't. And now I can.
And yet we think it's such a find to go through someone's attic, someone's basement and pull out all dusty, dirty old books that have been sitting there that are just as grimy as something coming out of these garbage that you can just wipe off. It's really funny.
I can't wait for them to
hypocrisy
find a classic
at its best.
That's worth thousands or something. Yeah. I can't wait for something like that to happen, right?
Yeah, and then how many of us are going through bags looking.
Or then you're going to get the people like, I did not mean to throw that out. I meant to throw all my other stuff out, but this, I didn't mean to put it in the garbage. You basically
Sir, you got a real interesting topic also outside of that one. Another one, a follow-up. I think this is a great day for Ryan. A very famous fiction writer is actually releasing a non-fiction story to mix in with his growing, and I mean growing, a fan of this writer, a growing collection of work. Are we talking about?
So it's James Patterson, right? Like, how surprising is that he's just going to, hey, you know what? I don't like my book selling 5 million copies of my fiction titles. I'm going to switch it up and let's do this without a pseudonym or anything, right? It's just like, hey, let's toss this one out there and see what where the fan blows it. And it's interesting to me because it's got such an awesome premise and it's a really cool book and the whole initiative behind it really shocked me. And I was like, wow, I didn't realize the amount of charity work that this gentleman does. James Patterson is really involved. Mm. It's called The Secret Lives of Librarians and Booksellers. It kind of just goes along people that he's met, librarians, and there's interviews, there's all kinds of different things, and it's really cool. But the coolest thing about it is that once you purchase the book, it opens up a website, or you can, whether it's the ebook, hard copy, audiobook, which isn't released yet, unfortunately, but it's coming soon, you get to nominate someone to win an award, to win like, I don't know exactly know what it's called. But that's the cool part. And all these perks come with the award and you're going to get recognized. I'm sure you're going to get to meet James Patterson at the very least. You know, you get to do all this stuff. But what's really great is that he's choosing 250 booksellers or librarians from a union in the United States. And he's giving them $200 out of his pocket just because they're in the literacy world and they're doing their thing and helping out and helping him get books into people's arms, whether it's his or otherwise. And I think that's really cool. You can nominate yourself if you're a librarian out there and you're listening, or you can have others nominate you, but there's going to be 200, and, he said 200 to 250 awards of this $200 for librarians, and you have to be a part of ALA. And I don't know what that stands for. On the websites I saw, I just typed in ALA and a bunch of things came up when I Googled it. So I'm not quite sure what union or what group that is, but if you're a part of it, it's really cool because it's interesting. And he's a fiction writer. Like he collaborated with Bill Clinton on a couple of huge books that have sold millions of copies. And now, you know, Kelly said he's a huge fan. He's got tons of books. Like I stopped counting at 50, and I know there's tons more. Wow. of the thriller series, the mystery series. He's just a fantastic guy, but it sounds like even more so within the philanthropy world, because over his lifetime to literacy and reading programs, he was given $100 million, which is a shocking number to me.
American Library Association, by the way.
That's what it is. Okay.
Yeah.
I have to ask, sorry to put you on the spot here, but the first thing I thought of when I read this was, what are the secret lives of librarians and booksellers? Like, do you have any, I don't know, can you give us a little bit of a sneak peek? Like, I don't know.
Read the little synopsis of it, and it's kind of cool because it's like, hey, have you ever had to spend the night in like a 100-year-old library with dusty old books? Like, imagine the stories. And I almost what came to mind was the Robin Williams movie, Night at the Museum, right? And that's I was like, do the books come alive? And like some of the weird things that your mind can play tricks on you. And I think, or even just the things that you think you've seen, right? We talked about, hey, what if someone threw out a classic and it's worth thousands. Imagine as a bookseller, someone brings that in and it turns out to be an original something or other, right? And it's like some of the cool things you've seen in the course of your life. So I think that's where it's going with this. And obviously there's an interest from James Patterson to divulge this kind of research, this kind of time and devotion into it. So I think it's going to be really well done. I mean, everything he writes turns to gold in the fiction world, in the thriller world. So I could see this having a huge impact too on his career as well.
I just love his collaborations because he's so with so many people supporting. And again, you see that generosity, whether it's lending his skills, his name to work with somebody on something and churns out so much work. It's unbelievable. He's everywhere.
And I love the authenticity, you know, like the Bill Clinton, you have a former president because they wrote The President's Daughter and The President is Missing, I believe, are the two books in the reverse order. But I believe those two are fantastic. I've listened to them a couple times each and they're really, really good.
Let's talk narrators just for a moment. Another famous celebrity is making their way into the audiobook narration game. Who?
Yes, this isn't new, but I think this one's going to be a huge seller. And Whoopi Goldberg is getting her voice back into audiobook narration and spoken word. And she's going to narrate Camino Ghosts by John Grisham. And that's set to come out later this year. And Grisham is a very well-known and very famous author with some great work. So this is going to be a masterpiece, I think.
Wow. That's going to be fun. Always good to have more authentic in this world where we're plugging everything into AI generated voices or whatever. Isn't it not great to have like famous, authentic people doing our narration? And that's really the beauty of an audiobook, I think.
Well, she's got a very distinct voice, but what I'm looking at is, you know what? I really want to hear her do what she thinks the other character's voice is, right? Like she'll narrate in pretty much her own voice, but like, what about character one and character five? And what voices can she toss out? Because I think she'll be really good at it.
Me too. I know it. I think I've heard her do different voices, whether on Star Trek and stuff like that, telling stories. So it'll be great.
Fantastic.
Absolutely will.
Always great to talk to you, Ryan. I'm going to chat with you next Friday. Thanks so much for coming on to chat all things books.
Have a great weekend, guys. Take good care.
Talk to Ryan next Friday and every Friday for the Chatty Bookshelf.
After the break, ladies and gentlemen, coming up next, let's revisit and weigh in on conversations from the past week. We call the segment Cut for Time, and we welcome for the first time to do Cut for Time with us, producer for our show, Laura Bain. Stay tuned.
It's fun, insightful, and inclusive. Kelly and Ramya return in a minute.
Welcome back to Kelly and Rumi. And as we get closer to your weekend and that gateway to the weekend gets swung wide open, we still got work to do, ladies and gentlemen. We welcome in to join Grant and I, producer Laura Bain. Laura, welcome. It's wonderful to have you working alongside the team for the next while. And we hope that the first, what's this, couple of weeks now? We have gone all right. I guess week, right?
Just first week. And it's wonderful to be here, Kelly. And thanks so much. It's awesome to be back in the AMI family for a little bit.
All right. Really wonderful.
Fantastic to have you here. And I'm trying to figure out what the vibe is going to be for this segment. Kelly, you said we still have work to do. So I'm taking off my fun hat and putting on my getting back to the grind here. All right, let's just launch right into it. So I'm kidding. On Monday, orientation and mobility specialist Mark Rankin chatted about which aspects of O&M are changing, but also what's staying the same.
When you think of the core sort of things that we teach, which is the beginning stuff, is especially with someone who's younger, vision loss, you've got to make sure that they're learning their concepts and that they've got they're able to integrate their sensory information. And those two things go hand in hand. And there's not much of a substitute for that. I mean, there's no substitute for firsthand experience of the world, right? If you want to make sense of the world, the best thing to do is to go out and put your hands on it and listen to it. And if you do have some vision, to look at it. And that's hasn't changed that much. There's certainly ways in which you can use technology to kind of help develop concepts.
Yeah, I mean, there might be some day when technology, you know, becomes a, you know, more of a miracle and can help with everything. But in my experience, you know, being in a community where, to be honest, orientation and mobility skills seem to me like they are often weaker than they should be, it really makes me think that there are often two kinds of mobility training that people receive. One kind is very, like, situational, practical focus only on the routes that you're covering at that moment, like walk until you reach a set of stairs, climb the stairs, square up here, turn right, you know, whatever it is, get to the curb, whatever. But the really valuable kind is that strategic mobility, telling you how to solve problems, teaching how to figure out the cardinal directions, teaching you just stuff that you might not be able to observe without sight about how the roads are designed, you know, common concepts for how street addresses and blocks are laid out, just all kinds of stuff that I really think is often lacking in education. And I'm not even really sure, although there is probably a standard curriculum, quote unquote, I'm not really sure how standardized the instruction is about when everything needs to be implemented and how it needs to be taught. Laura, I know you've touched on this a little bit in Halifax. I would say certainly looking at my own education in that subject left a lot to be desired. What do you think about orientation mobility, any of the things I've touched on, or just, you know, how it could be improved?
Yeah, Grant, I think you're so right about the need for those global skills. And honestly, I feel so fortunate to have learned O&M kind of in that way here through the School for the Blind. And essentially, you know, I know in the segment it was talking a lot about sort of technology, but just gaining those, like, quote unquote, old school blind skills of learning sort of the layout of the city. You mentioned those cardinal directions. I feel like I was always the only kid my age who knew in terms of north, south, east, and west. But also the ability to go up and talk to strangers. And that was something that my O&M instructor really forced me to do from a young age. And I'm just so grateful because I feel like it served me not just in terms of navigating, but also things like employment and social situations. So I love assistive technology. I use it when I get, you know, disoriented, but I do hope that it's also being taught in terms of those global skills.
Yeah, feel the same way. I love that you've mentioned, Laura, the going up and talking to people, because so many kids are raised, don't talk to strangers, don't do this, be very wary of people. And sure, we were taught the same thing, but also to utilize people, to utilize not knowledge of the directions that you mentioned. Because as you say, Laura, I was the only kid that knew, oh, that's out of the north or that, let's go west. What are you talking about? And it really really did me good later on. Got to the point, though, where I was a bit obsessive about North, South, East, and West. Wherever I was, whether I was in Toronto or somewhere, I had to know, okay, North is over there. And it was almost like I was a bird with that kind of a radar. But I also liked when Mark mentioned how much he learns from the students. I like the fact that he knows his students, that you get to know. I've worked with Mark, and even the first time I worked with him, it was like he knew, because he knew the little things. We can't look at signs and say, oh yeah, there's number 35 over there and be okay. It was finding the landmarks, figuring out your walking, what you tend to do, your tendencies. And if you have someone doing mobility with you that's either grown up teaching you from an early start, or you learned the basic skills at somewhere like a W. Ross or the Halifax School, you really had an opportunity to be able to keep those things in your pocket for down the road for your own travels later. So really wonderful. Enjoyed the segment with Mark really well. Last Thursday, folks, we spoke to Fern Lullum about body image and how we can think differently about the way we look.
Why do we so often have insecurities about the way we look?
I think there are so many factors that go into this, Brock. So there is, you know, we grow up, we have certain experiences maybe when in childhood. So we might have our parents sort of making comments about the way that we look, you know, or we might have a brother or sister that might be, you know, more attractive than us, or at least that's what everyone is telling us. We always compare ourselves to them. We might kind of be bullied at school for the way that we look, and that can, you know, we can carry that with us throughout our lives and always remember those horrible comments that were made. Talking of comparison, we live in a world of comparison. You know, we have social media these days where everyone is looking perfect, or at least so it would seem on the screen. And so we compare ourselves to everyone that we think is just a normal person. You know, like right back in the day, people used to compare themselves to models that they'd see in magazines. And at least you could say, but they're models. But these days, it just looks like everyday people are looking stunning constantly. And how can we compare with that? How can we keep up?
As a blind person, it was something I never cared about, especially wardrobe-wise. I mean, look, I'm a big guy, and as I mentioned during the segment, some of the issues that I've had have been places with trying to find wardrobe and plays. And people don't mean any negative comment, I hope, but to say to me, well, let's see what we can find that'll fit you, you know, and say it in that way, it's like, oh my God, it's got an impossible task ahead of me. It makes you feel like, well, okay. So when I've had the question, how much racism have you encountered as a black person? Not as much as I have as a blind or a heavier person or a bigger person, however way you're comfortable describing that. And I've also learned, well, what makes me feel good that way? And we are so affected by social media, clothes on, what people wear on TV. I remember my favorite characters on TV. Oh, I wanted to wear that kind of jacket that guy wore and stuff like that. I can't afford that. Okay, then something that kind of looks the same, maybe made out of something cheaper. You know, it was what we decided for our own feeling better. And then you start asking yourself, well, why do I care? And some people go that far to not care, to not feel they need to get into it, to not make it a big deal for them. So they're fine with that. And I know a lot of time I waited for Christmas and whatever my family handed me, yay, those are the clothes for the year. And especially before I worked, when I started to work and tried to find what I wanted to wear, had the budget to kind of look for the things I'd like to wear. And one of the greatest compliments that an NBA basketball player gave me on showing up and how I looked went really far with me. Not because it quantified what I was wearing, that I was doing the right thing, good for me. It was because he made me feel that I had that sense and respect for myself and also them. And I needed him to explain to me what he meant. And he kind of meant that there are people that show up here to do these interviews with us wearing a little less than what one would say is respectable, showing up in their track pants and, hey, ready to do my big interview with you. And they just felt sometimes, yeah, I'm sure you're ready. You look the part. And for me, not ever having someone really say that in that capacity, it was darn flattering. I will say that for sure. Grant, any experiences you want to share?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you bring this up because we just had a big discussion about this with my family yesterday over dinner. It's funny with body image because it's that one thing that is totally subjective. It should not matter at all, but absolutely does, unfortunately, matter in the world. Either if you have low body image, also maybe if you have... you're on the other side where you're getting a lot of compliments and such and such. And then you always have to wonder if your self-worth is, you know, just linked to that positive body image that you've developed. I have to say for myself, one of the most frustrating things also goes back to wardrobe, because I don't particularly care in terms of, you know, I can't look in the mirror or, you know, observe the colors and textures and whatever that I'm wearing, but I would like to be able to control the statement I'm making. And that's really hard for me because, for example, one of the things I get told all the time is I look very conservative, which I'm not at all in terms of my beliefs and my values, a little TMI, but I think I dress very, very conservatively, and I've been struggling a lot with like, how can I kind of change my style without being too outrageous, but to look a little bit more sort of fun and, you know, upbeat, whatever. And it's really, really tough because all we have to go on is the people in our lives who are telling us and giving us advice. But I feel like for me, I don't have as much control as I would like to have, over my image and controlling that style and the statement that I absolutely am making visually. Laura, any thoughts?
Yeah, and I just really appreciate the perspective that you both are bringing in terms of kind of body image and having like low to no vision. And I feel that's something that I'm sort of encountering more as I get older and my vision deteriorates, is that I sort of have less of a sense of what's typical in terms of like, what kind of pants do people wear? Like, what's appropriate in this situation? I have no idea. Like, yeah. People might tell me, you know, my partner says, oh, like lots of people wear sweatpants out to, you know, brunch or whatever. Okay, well, you know, it's just hard when you can't kind of observe for yourself what is like the norm, or maybe as Grant says, like expressing a particular style. But just kind of going back to that conversation you had with Fern, I feel like it's become so pervasive and like normalized, even expected for us to criticize ourselves in terms of yes. how we look and our bodies, and like even, you know, talking about dieting after the holidays and things like that. And I struggle with it a bit because I'm definitely interested in health and wellness and nutrition and all of that. But these social standards that have absolutely nothing to do with health, and quite frankly, like often have to do with things like racism or patriarchy, kind of get tangled up in conversations about health. So I feel like we need to make that, we need to make that more conscious and not kind of have this rhetoric of health when it's really nothing to do with health.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. So from Monday's show on Know Your Rights, Daniel McLaughlin and Senator Kim Pate reflected on the recent details announced about the Canada Disability Benefit.
People with disabilities aren't a big voting block, apparently. And so the fact that the money hasn't been allocated in the way that it was promised is disgraceful. And but it seems to be only political. And even the delay in getting it was political. And, you know, there's something in the bill, but it's almost, you know, I can't think of a better way of framing it than a slap in the face. That's exactly, I mean, it's worse than that. It's keeping people in incredibly dire straits at the same time as, you know, everybody's struggling, yes, but there are some people struggling far more.
You know, what I so appreciated about this conversation was how Danielle and Senator Pate didn't tiptoe around sort of that disconnect between what the government talked about and what has been announced. They really didn't mince their words there. I've been following the disability benefit pretty closely, and I have to say, personally, like, I've never felt so betrayed by the government. I don't want to be too negative, but this has really impacted me the last week and a half or so, because I honestly believed that this benefit was going to make a difference in the lives of people with disabilities and be something along the lines of a guaranteed basic income, which is what was being talked about, and like lift folks up to, or ideally above, the poverty line. But one aspect that's not getting, you know, quite as much attention, it was touched on during this segment, as the dollar amount is the fact that it's going to be tied to household rather than individual income. And this is despite advice from organizations such as the Disabled Women's Network of Canada, who spoke to the government about the issue, like the issue of intimate partner violence, which is disproportionately high amongst people with disabilities, and how that's often tied to people having economic dependence on an abusive partner. And also, you know, there was, I know, testimony from people who spoke about being a couple in a couple where both people have disabilities and having to pretend to be roommates and not being able to get married if you want to, or even having to live in separate dwellings because you don't want to have your benefits clawed back. So for me, it's just really disappointing that the government has seemingly pretty much ignored everything that they've been told from the community and from experts. Grant, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Laura, you said it so well, and it's just a couple of things really going on here with the benefits for people who are unemployed or underemployed, and also just the structural challenges in this country with getting a job for people who are very able and want to work, and keeping you tied to just horrible, undignified or abusive situations that are hard to escape from. Yeah, I just don't know. I love my country, but we have a lot of work to do in terms of valuing people who have intrinsic self-worth but are not very valued in our society. I wish I could end on a better note. Kelly?
Guys, you said so much there, and I go back to the fact that, like you mentioned, they've ignored everything that was said, the things that would make different, and those concerns. Hey, I shouldn't have to hold off on getting married. I shouldn't have to lie about this person being, I shouldn't have to be dependent on someone else. We shouldn't have to live in a country where we allow landlords just to keep raising rent higher and higher and then talking about, oh, gee, a lot of people living on the street. Ooh, the number's getting bigger. We shouldn't here have to do that any more than we should have to think about how come people are starving. Laura, thank you very much for participating in your first Cut for Time with us. Next week, we have you back for the buzz.
Happy to be around.
Enjoy the weekend.
Thanks.
Producer Laura Bain joining Grant and I on the Cut for Time. And as mentioned, she'll be back next week as we do the buzz Wednesday through Friday. After the break, we'll tell you what's coming up on AMI TV, AMI Audio, a couple of highlights for you for the weekend. And look up, look way up, there's a giraffe. Yeah, he's got a couple of neck and back problems that we'll hear about. Yeah, it just needs a slight adjustment. We'll talk about it after this.
We'll be back with more of Kelly and Ramya after this short break.
A lot of good topics, folks, that we talked about on Cut for Time. Welcome back to Kelly and Ramya. If you want to check them out yourself or other segments or the full show, remember, subscribe to the Kelly and Ramya podcast. You can do it using your favorite podcast platform. While you're in there, if you don't mind, give us a rating and review and check out other AMI content that's available to you via podcast. Grant and I are going to tell you a little bit about what's going on over the weekend on our networks. Over on AMI Audio, let's start with keep up with the latest in accessible technology with Double Tap. Saturdays on AMI Audio, join hosts Stephen Scott and Sean Priest as they discuss news, reviews, and technology stories of interest to people who are blind, partially sighted, and members of the disability community. Listen to Double Tap Saturdays at noon Eastern on AMI Audio.
We've got the feature film Patch Adams, starring the late Robin Williams, and that's airing Sunday on AMI TV. The movie tells the true story of Hunter Patch Adams, a medical doctor who uses the healing power of humor and human connection with his patients. It's been nominated for Golden Globe Award. Patch Adams, it's going to air Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on AMI TV.
So, I don't know, Grant, if you're a massage person, if you've ever had you know, a chiropractor work done on you, or any of these adjustments, right? No, okay. And I don't, you know, I don't know where all in the field they end up having to go, especially a chiropractor. But here's an item that they discovered. A chiropractor works on a giraffe, gets a little bit of a nuzzly hug. But aren't giraffes kind of just like giant dogs? This is by Kathy Free, this item. It came out on yesterday, as a matter of fact. When you're a chiropractor and you get a call about a 16-foot giraffe that might need some help, what do you do? Jump in your car. That's how an Oklahoma chiropractor, Jordan Whitley, drove about 2 hours to a ranch in Ardmore, Oklahoma, to examine Jerry the giraffe. I wonder how many times you could say that. Jerry giraffe, Jerry giraffe, Jerry giraffe. Wow. Maybe a bunch, maybe. It kind of rolls. It kind of sounds okay.
That rolls.
Whitley, it's not bad, right? Like, you could kind of get away with that one. Jerry the giraffe. Whitley, who recorded himself and Jerry during the exam, assessed Jerry's neck and jaw because the giraffe's owner said he's chewing oddly, though did not seem to be in any pain. Whitley applied pressure in spots around Jerry's jaw and neck and helped to restore motion to his joints. I find this amazing. And of course, he got that little nuzzle. And of course, they had something to put up on YouTube that goes viral, right? It's always the case. But I wonder, does a chiropractor, as he said, jump in the car, do this without the reservations of, number one, it's a big giraffe, I'm looking at little old me, but do you worry about making a mistake? This isn't a human that can actually respond to you, tell you, hey, don't do that. And again, things can happen. But you, how much of a giraffe's physical makeup do you know? So I thought this was fascinating, Grant, and it gave you a smile, and I hope gives everyone a smile for the weekend.
Ends the show on a little bit of a bright note, but yeah, I don't know. Would I make a mistake? Would I injure him? I don't know. I don't know if I would do that, but glad. Yeah,
I think I'd be a bit nervous. Folks, we're back, Grant and I, on Monday. Michael Babcock will kick us off, sharing tips for using Microsoft Outlook, for using JAWS through signatures and folders and flagging messages and inbox rules.
Better than my unorganized inbox. Also, we catch up with Jenny, with the host of the AMI original podcast, Low Vision Moments, Jenny Boover. She's going to highlight the recent episode, Run for Your Life, with guest Daryl and the experience of her first half marathon.
All right, folks, the gateway to the weekend's open now. Get out of here, will ya?
Hosts, Kelly McDonald and Ramya Amadin.
Reporter, Grant Hardy.
Reporter, Beth Deer.
Senior producer, Matt Agnew.
Visual producers, Megan McGraw and Jeff Ryman.
Producer, Marianne Dion Jones.
Graphics, Andrew Antonello.
Production assistant, Kingsley Juco.
Control room operators, Daniel Penamondo, Eliza Rocco, Parker Oxtoby, Caitlin Robinson, James Kennedy.
Operations assistant, Jordan Mulgrove. Director, Irene Solomon.
Manager of live production, Paula Dineen.
Manager of operations, Kyle Harper.
Manager of AMI audio, Andy Frank.
Director of TV production, Kara Nye.
Vice President, Content Development and Production, John Melville.
President and CEO, David Arrington.
Give us your feedback. 1-866-509-4545.
Copyright 2021, Accessible Media, Inc. I remember a time they were getting goal ball going in London, and some of us were going out to watch and participate. And I would get asked, hey, aren't you going to play? And I was doing AMI this week then, blindsided. So I said, I don't know. I love goal ball, and I do. It was the one sport I've really enjoyed. I had a good time dealing with it and just having fun in it when I played it much more regularly and stuff like that. But I also recognize that if I get hit in the face, it's, yeah, guys, sorry, I can't do this shoot today, let alone now where I worry more about cupboard doors. Banged my head recently off one right in the face because some dummy left it open. Oh, you're pointing your fingers at me. Okay, so you understand. It's so funny because it was the big concern. I mean, that was a great cop-out of doing things, but and I remember the person saying to me, what do you mean? I don't know if you know anything about goal ball, folks, but you play it with blindfolds, and the goal is, in goal ball, to stop the ball, to make sure that you get down there on the floor and cut it off before scoring on you, and your net reaches from behind the left winger all the way to the right winger. I was a center when I played competitively years ago. Anyway, my way of playing is to dive for the ball, and back then, I'd get lots of hits in the face, lots of scrapes by the ball. Didn't mind, it was part of the game. They play it differently now, and those who play probably are a little smarter about it than we were in the early days of it, and now that it's become so highly competitive and especially part of the Paralympics. So maybe that would be avoided. But I said, I can't afford to take the chance. Can't have that many hits in the money maker.
Hello, I'm Sean Preece. Join me monthly for Sean of the Shed, where I introduce you to all the technology that can be so useful to us as blind or partially sighted people. Find Sean of the Shed wherever you find all your podcasts.